What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. The bottom line is, Adam, you've been spending a lot of time with this lady. You're a member of the Film Spotting news team.
That's a given. That's a given.
We need you. Hell, I need you. I'm a mess without you. I miss you so damn much. I miss being with you.
Yes, we miss Anchorman's Ron Burgundy.
I miss his musk.
All right, that's enough of that. But for this week's top five, we're focusing on the filmmakers we've been missing. We'll count down our top five directors who need a comeback.
Plus a review of Roman Coppola's first film in 12 years, A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan III, starring Charlie Sheen and Bill Murray. Don't call it a comeback. Well, actually, yeah, we're calling it a comeback. All that and more ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com/film and use offer code FILM2. That's Shutterstock.com/film and offer code FILM2.
And by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and iPod. Listen whenever and wherever you want, just like the podcasts you are listening to right now. Audible has more than 100,000 titles to choose from in every genre.
And Josh, I've charged you with coming up with one of those 100,000 titles that you can recommend to our audience. What do you have?
It wasn't that hard, actually. I know that Steven Spielberg's Lincoln didn't cast that much of a spell over you, Adam, but it did for me. And the one element that really took me by surprise was how it made the legislative process behind the passage of the 13th Amendment absolutely enthralling. Now, a lot of the meat for that story came from Doris Kearns Goodwin's nonfiction book, A Team of Rivals, which I was aware of before, but the movie has increased my interest in quite a bit. Audible has an unabridged version that runs 41 hours.
Wow.
I don't know if I'm quite that interested. So I'm glad to see that they also have an unabridged version. That one's only 9 hours.
Probably more my speed as well. We also have two listener recommendations here. These come to us via our Facebook page, facebook.com/filmspotting, or you can also email us feedback@filmspotting.net. And for whatever reason, Josh, on our Facebook wall, I couldn't find our most recent post with comments, but I found one from June 2012, and I think these recommendations still hold up. I hope I'm going to say this name halfway right, and I love it if it is, in fact, a real name. Pensive Flaneur.
That sounds like a fake Facebook name to me.
Pensive is a lot of fun to say, though, and the recommendation of he or she is Perks of Being a Wallflower. Since this was June of last year, it says listen to it before the movie, directed by author Stephen Chbosky, comes out this fall. It did come out last year, one we never talked about on the show, but I caught up with during the screener season and really liked, actually. I think it's a good film. I'm curious about the audiobook as well. Pensive says, I'm also loving The Chaperone, about a 15-year-old Louise Brooks making her first journey to New York City. We also heard from listener Kimberly Reist, who recommends Christopher Tabori reading Jeffrey Eugenides' Middlesex. Kimberly calls it unforgettable, one of the best narrations ever.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/film. That's audiblepodcast.com/film.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. We'll see if I can redeem my review of Animal Crackers last week, as we've got the second film in our Marx Brothers marathon, Monkey Business, and also that review of Charles Swan III a little bit later in the show, because we're shaking things up a little bit this week, Josh. We're not starting with the review as we usually do.
Yeah, it just didn't feel right to start the show with Charlie Sheen.
No. No, it really didn't. So for this week, for those of you who never make it to the end of an episode of Film Spotting, a taste of what you've been missing with the first half of this week's top five directors who need a comeback. Josh, you're going to get us started. So first, why don't you set up your criteria for deciding who these directors were and who's your number five?
First of all, I want to point out we spared ourselves what would have been an epic argument, because before Django Unchained, I would have put Tarantino on this list, actually.
Say it isn't so.
True, true. But let's move on. Ideally for me, I needed to have seen the director's more recent stuff, even if it hadn't been very heralded, just so I could make that comparison. So that was one requirement. This also didn't necessarily have to mean for me that they've made bad films lately. It could also mean that they just haven't been as relevant in the film world as perhaps I feel they should have been or I feel they can be when they're working at the height of their powers. And my number five is actually an example of that. It's Jim Jarmusch. I've liked Jarmusch's recent films well enough, just not nearly as much as his 1-2 punch of the 90s, Dead Man and Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai. Those are among my favorites of his. Ghost Dog starred, of course, Forrest Whitaker, and I think he may come up again when we talk about this week's poll. I'd pretty much forgotten about Jarmusch, to be honest with you, and I stumbled across his cameo while catching up with the HBO series Bored to Death. It was probably an earlier episode, but he did pop up there. His comeback actually might be this year, because he does have a film coming out called Only Lovers Left Alive, and it's a vampire movie starring film-spotting favorite Tom Hiddleston. The cast also has Tilda Swinton and Mia Wasikowska, so that sounds promising. Now, Jarmusch and vampires, they may not seem like a natural match, but I'm going to trust the guy who made a great movie out of Samurai Rap.
Yeah, absolutely. And that film, you're right, as I look at his filmography, was 1999. He did Coffee and Cigarettes in 2003, which I think I've seen, but the fact that I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those.
Maybe there. And then Broken Flowers in 2005 with Bill Murray, and Tilda Swinton makes an appearance in that film as well. I like that movie, so that's kind of why I left him off or didn't really consider him. But he did make in 2009 The Limits of Control, and I remember just not really having any interest whatsoever in seeing that film and it not really getting any good buzz. So I think Jim Jarmusch is definitely a good pick. A couple names I want to throw out there because I wonder if we'll get emails along these lines, and it will help set up a little bit how we both, I think, approach these lists a little bit. I was thinking about a guy like Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, which is just a fun name to say. He's the guy who made the great film The Lies of Others a few years ago. And then, yes, he made the movie The Tourist.
I was trying to remember what he did after
Angelina
that.
Angelina Jolie debacle. And so I'm with anyone that feels like he could be in need of a comeback after The Tourist, but I guess I just don't feel the urgency there. He's only made two films. One was very good, one maybe not so much, but that's just two movies total. Let's give him some time to establish a little bit of a director's arc. And I was also thinking about a guy like Craig Brewer, who made two films I loved in Hustle and Flow and Black Snake Moan. And then, Footloose was kind of an abomination. I hated it. And I guess on some level, I'd like to see him come back from that bad film. But again, just didn't really seem appropriate for this list.
Are you due for a comeback if you've only made one unsuccessful film, I guess?
That's basically what I'm thinking. So for me, similar to what you said, Josh, they had to pass the smell test. Their stock had to be down a little bit, whether they've been off the radar completely for a while or just that I now have doubts about any new project from them. It's no longer a given that you can expect a good film from them. I also did rule out, and I think this will be key as we go through these lists, because I'm sure that already people listening are thinking about directors who need to come back and they're going to some of these names in their heads. But I didn't want to include any so-called old masters. People like Francis Ford Coppola and Peter Bogdanovich and Roman Polanski even, that almost seems like a separate list to me. That seems like directors who need to find the rejuvenation machine.
Yeah, could
directors
be.
Who you hope could one day regain their old form but are past their prime, frankly, probably. I'm thinking of directors who are in need of a comeback who are still vital and still maybe somewhat in their prime. And then the big thing for me, Josh, is I really thought about this list because I came up with 10 to 20 candidates, good ones like I'm sure you did. But the way I whittled it down was thinking about the filmmakers who I thought were really capable of making personal films, special films that we're missing as a film community. These filmmakers all have a voice, and I wish this voice came back. So with that in mind, I think that really does segue nicely into my number five pick, who is Mike Judge. And I'm calling him, for the purposes of my list, the satirist. This is the guy who gave us Office Space, which I suppose is a cult classic. I think that's how a lot of people refer to it. But this is a movie I think is going to go on forever as maybe one of the most quoted films of all time. I think it defined a corporate world apathy that I want to say was of its time, the late 90s, but really is probably pretty timeless. And then he made after that Idiocracy, which is a film that at times is just brilliant in its satire of corporatism and commercialism run amok, the dumbing down of art and entertainment and politics and America in general. And I think about what's happened in this country, in the world, over the last 6 years since Idiocracy came out. You're telling me this isn't ripe for Mike Judge's satire? Think about social media and its prevalence and how our political landscape has become even more fractured than it was then. The economy is, of course, a big thing. And he got into that a little bit, Josh, with his 2009 film that followed Idiocracy, Extract. This is a film with Kristen Wiig and Jason Bateman. There's that corporate world aspect where he owns a plant and he's kind of deciding what kind of business owner he wants to be and whether or not he should sell out. But it wasn't a very good movie. It just wasn't very funny at all. So that strike against him does have me a little bit worried about anything else he might do. And I don't know what else he is going to do, because after that, the only thing on his IMDb page is a TV movie called Silicon Valley that's dated 2013 that I've heard nothing about whatsoever. I don't know where Mike Judge is, but I think we need his voice back.
For the last time, I'm pretty sure what's killing the crops is this Brondo stuff.
The Brondo's got what plants crave. It's got electrolytes.
So wait a minute. What you're saying is that you want us to put water on the crops?
Yes.
Water. Like out the toilet?
Well, I mean, it doesn't have to be out of the toilet, but yeah, that's the idea.
But Brondo's got what plants crave.
It's got electrolytes.
Okay, look. The plants aren't growing, so I'm pretty sure that the Brondo's not working. Now, I'm no botanist, but I do know that if you put water on plants, they grow.
Well, I've never seen no plants grow out of no toilet.
Hey, that's good. You sure you ain't the smartest guy in the world?
Yeah.
Okay, look, you want to solve this problem. I want to get my pardon, so why don't we just try it, okay? And not worry about what plants crave.
Brondo's got what plants crave.
Yeah, if Idiocracy didn't work well enough for you, I can understand putting him on the list. There was plenty of comic brilliance there for me to kind of overlook what was a pretty clunky film otherwise.
Yeah.
Extract, though, definitely did not live up to my expectations. It just didn't have that angry comic energy that his other stuff did. So yeah, he makes sense on this list. My number four is going to probably break one of your criteria a little bit. I don't know if you would consider this director an old master, but he's been at it for a while. It's George Romero. And I always find it odd, something of an irony, that the zombie renaissance, which I'd probably place around the time of 2002's 28 Days Later, it's taken place without the grandfather of the genre in a lot of ways. His Land of the Dead, which was 2005, I did like that movie well enough. There's some class commentary going on there that's pretty interesting. But I found Survival of the Dead and then Diary of the Dead, which were his most recent efforts, to be really underwhelming. Now, I know the guy is in his 70s, I believe. He may not be interested in making many more movies, but being a fan of zombie films, mm-hmm. especially, I'd really like to see him go out on top, if that's possible.
Yeah, I think you make a great case for Romero there. And you're right, he could possibly fit into that old masters category, but he's definitely still making films. And I'm with you that those last two maybe weren't up to what we would hope for from him. I do love the fact that you cited the start of the zombie renaissance with 28 Days Later, a movie I've been on record here on the show as saying is in fact a zombie movie, whether or not the characters in it are technically
zombies.
Yeah,
I know there's that argument out there.
That started a whole firestorm here on the show. So as you said that, listeners already started firing up their keyboards and were sending you hate mail, Josh, which
it's a zombie movie. It really is.
I'm with you. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're starting the show here with our top five directors who need a comeback. And my number four is a guy I'm calling the not-so-alpha male. He is Dylan Kidd. He broke onto the scene in 2002 with the film Roger Dodger, starring Campbell Scott and a very young Jesse Eisenberg, making, I believe, his feature film debut. I've talked about this movie a lot here on Film Spotting over the years, and what I love about Dylan Kidd and his voice is he's a guy, you certainly see this in Roger Dodger, who has some fun reveling in a certain male chauvinism while also completely undercutting it and lampooning it. And we see that in the development and the evolution, if you can call it the evolution, of Campbell Scott's character in Roger Dodger.
What's happening right now is important only in the context of our continuing evolution as a species.
Roger, okay? Roger, all I'm saying is that I wish my sister would learn to read a subway map.
And by saying that, you disregard the primary importance of utility in human relationships. Our ability, men's ability to read maps, to navigate, makes us useful. You should discourage your sister from even looking at a map.
Are you saying that we women have an inferior sense of direction?
Which way is north, Joyce, without looking around?
What?
You heard me. Point north, quick. North, north. Quick, north, 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 north.
Are you right?
Is he right?
He's right.
Very impressive.
Oh. As she has throughout history, the female responds to the male who displays the most utility. By honing those skills which make me useful, I stave off my inevitable obsolescence.
That was 2002, so that was a while ago. And then in 2004, he made the movie P.S. with Topher Grace and Laura Linney. If I'm remembering it right, she plays an admissions counselor maybe at an NYU-type school, and Topher Grace gets accepted. They come in contact with each other, and she's convinced that he is her high school sweetheart who died, somehow reincarnated in the form of Topher Grace, and it's just okay.
Yeah.
But even if that was halfway decent, he hasn't made a movie since then, since 2004, and I'm thinking again about what's missing in our current landscape, and I think about some of the prominent issues that films have tried to deal with over the past few years. Gender roles are only going to get more and more skewed and blurred, and I feel like a voice like Dylan Kidd's to navigate it is really essential, where you know it will be serious and he'll make some substantive points, but also have a lot of comedy in there. And he does have a movie coming out. I did see on IMDb that this year he's scheduled to have a film come out called Get a Job. And it's got a pretty decent cast. Anna Kendrick, Bryan Cranston, Christopher Mintz-Plasse, Alison Brie, and Miles Teller, who I'm also a big fan of. So I have some optimism because of that cast, because of Dylan Kidd. But having been so long and coming off the mostly mediocre PS, I do have my doubts. I'm hoping this is a triumphant return for him.
Mostly mediocre, that's probably a good way to describe PS. I had actually completely forgotten about Dylan Kidd, so good pick. My number three is a little bit bigger of a name, or at least was at one point in time, and that's Jane Campion. Some might argue she did make a comeback in 2009 when she made Bright Star, her period piece about John Keats.
I know some people
really went wild about it. For me, though, I did enjoy it. It never fully transcended the period trappings the way she did in something like The Piano, which is her masterpiece. Before Bright Star, she made 2003's In the Cut with Meg Ryan. That did not work for me at all.
No.
I also looked to see what she was doing, and I saw she's involved in a police procedural TV series. It's called In the Lake. Now, the cinema snob in me wants Jane Campion to be making movies. That may not be entirely fair, but that's what I want to see, and I want to see something on the level of The Piano again.
That's a great choice. My number three is Cameron Crowe. I'm calling him the realist on my list. He hasn't had a great film, a truly great film, since 2000, for me, Almost Famous. And he does have a film coming out. I believe it's still a question mark whether it's 2013 or probably 2014. And as of right now, all we know about it is Bradley Cooper and Emma Stone are attached. And having Emma Stone attached does help me get a little bit more excited about that project whenever it does come out. But I just think of him in terms of that realist voice, that authentic voice, an honest voice that comes through with Cameron Crowe. And you think about all of his most memorable characters, they're always people searching for that kind of honesty, whether in their career or in their relationships. They're trying to find something that is real and stripped of all the ego and greed and BS. Jerry Maguire, Lloyd Dobler, and Say Anything. William Miller, of course, and Almost Famous as well. Think about those conversations he has with Philip Seymour Hoffman as Lester Bangs.
Oh, man. You made friends with him. See, friendship is the booze they feed you. They want you to get drunk and feeling like you belong.
Well, it was fun.
Because they make you feel cool. And hey, I met you. You are not cool.
I know. Even when I thought I was, I knew I wasn't.
Yeah, because we are uncool. Now, while women will always be a problem for guys like us, most of the great art in the world is about that very problem.
That line from the movie about being uncool, that was originally the first title for Almost Famous, was The Uncool. And Cameron Crowe now is a guy who's 55 years old. He's not the voice of a generation anymore, if he ever was. Not someone making movies like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which he wrote the script for, and a movie like Singles. These are films that really felt like he was trying to be the voice of a generation, and I like those films a lot. But now he's a guy who, I believe, is focused on telling personal adult stories that do have a great mixture of comedy and pathos. But you look at his filmography, he made, after Almost Famous, Vanilla Sky, which I'm not a big fan of. Then it took 4 years to come out with Elizabethtown, which has some really nice moments in it, but otherwise was a mixed bag for me. And then it was a whole 6 years before we got We Bought a Zoo, which frankly just looks so dull and uninteresting. I never even saw it.
Certainly an odd picture to come from Crowe.
Yeah, and every time I've seen scenes from it on HBO, because it's been on HBO a lot, it never, ever holds my attention. So there has been a string, certainly, of some duds from Cameron Crowe. I have doubts about whether or not he truly will make that great Cameron Crowe film again, but I'm holding out hope.
Well, and here's the reason to hope for Crowe, is that you're right. He is a generational voice, and he's proven that he can do it through different generations. He's spoken for teenagers right. when he was closer to that age. Then he spoke for an older group with Jerry Maguire. So it almost seems like he's certainly capable of it. He just hasn't found that story lately to speak to where he's at now. And yep. I think it'll probably come.
I think that's exactly it. And you're right. If you look in the middle of those two, you mentioned Singles is a film that's right in between the guy who's in his mid-30s of Jerry Maguire and those high school kids. The people are now in their 20s saying, what am I supposed to do with my life? What do I stand for? So you're right. He's always been able to identify that and speak to it in a very real, authentic way. And I'm sure he can do that now as well. We'll see what happens with Cameron Crowe and his currently untitled Cameron Crowe project. We'll get to our last couple of picks for directors who need a comeback later in the show. But you can always start sending your feedback in now. Just go ahead and start berating us.
Get an early start, yeah.
Why not? You can write in with all the filmmakers we're surely going to forget. Get those emails in now, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
We do know better than to hold off Massacre Theater any longer, so we'll get to that next. And Adam will break out his harp, and I'll sit down at the piano for the second film in our Marx Brothers marathon, Monkey Business. Honk. Stay with us.
2, 3, 4. Focus. Keep it on the steam room. Never round the green room where the wind is blowing. Angels, devils know each other. Hang on to each other when they're going out on the town.
I'll run to catch the bus, but I can't find my shoe, so I'm staying with you alone. I start to scream for help, here comes the plan. Who made this mess?
Hey everyone, sorry to interrupt the show, but we did want to take a moment to talk about some of our sponsors here on Film Spotting, including Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/film.
We're also brought to you by Shutterstock. This is the site where you can find the perfect video for your next creative project. And I know we have a lot of creative listeners out there, including people who already use Shutterstock, whether for your website, an advertisement, or a multimedia presentation. They've got clips in a variety of digital formats, and most come in HD. They add 10,000 new video clips per week, so every time you visit, you'll find something new, and you can drill down and find exactly what you're looking for by category, clip resolution, contributor, and more. And Shutterstock is a complete offering. They have excellent customer service. Dedicated reps are standing by 24 hours a day, Monday through Friday, to help you out, and they have flexible pricing. You can choose between individual clips or get their video packs.
If you want to give Shutterstock a try, just sign up for a free account. There's no credit card needed. You can start an account, begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM2, and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's shutterstock.com/film, and for 30% off new accounts, use offer code FILM2. We thank Shutterstock for their support of Film Spotting.
Thanks. 10 cents. Brilliant. Thanks.
Excuse me?
Sorry.
Big issue?
Can't afford it.
This song you just played, you write it?
Working on it.
It's not an established song?
No, it's not an established song.
How come you don't play during daytime? I see you every day.
You know, during the day, people want to hear songs they know, just songs that they recognize. I mean, otherwise I wouldn't make any money. I play these songs at night. They wouldn't listen.
I listen.
Yeah, but you give me 10 cents.
Well, you do it for money then? Why don't you get a job in a shop?
I have a job in a shop. Listen, I'm going to get back to this, yeah?
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That's one of my man crushes, Josh. Glenn Hansard there with
Marketa
Urglova from the great little film Once. I believe 2005, that Irish musical drama, if you can call it that, and I believe that's how most people think of it. Certainly, it's filled with great music, especially from those two, Hansard and Urglova.
That clip makes me think we should do a Massacre Theater sometime of us singing their parts. I think we could pull that off.
That might be the worst idea I've ever heard, but that doesn't mean we won't do it. No, and that helps set up nicely our poll question we're going to get to a little bit later in this segment as we look forward to next week's show and Valentine's Day and our Valentine's theme top five. So keep Once in mind as we get to that question. But now it's time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, we massacred this scene.
I've known Louis Dana for a lot of years. He's been nothing but trouble. My mother used to say he's not such a bad guy. He just needs a chance, that he was sad. Well, I tried to be good to him, and I can't, not anymore. I will not allow him or his daughter in this house. I will not allow you to spend time with her doing projects or whatever it is that you do. That's it. I hope we're clear on that.
We're not clear.
What'd you say?
We're not clear. You and I aren't clear about anything. We couldn't be less clear.
Joseph
Francis. Just because Mom died doesn't mean that you know anything about me. You don't. You don't know anything about Alice either. She's kind.
I'm not gonna have this discussion.
She's
right now.
Nice to me.
I don't care what she is.
That was Joel Courtney as Joe Lamb and Kyle Chandler as Deputy Jackson Lamb in 2011 Super 8, written and directed, of course, by J.J. Abrams.
And we were being honest last week. Let's point this out when we said we didn't think there were any tie-ins to the show, any direct tie-ins
not
to last
really.
Week's show, other than the fact that J.J. Abrams was obviously in the news as the big announcement came out that he would be helming the next Star Wars effort. So that's really all we were
thinking. That's all we had.
Is he's in the news, we'll go with a J.J. Abrams film. But boy, our listeners sure caught on in ways that we obviously were too dumb to notice, Josh. We start with this one, first of all, from Scott Apostolou in Palo Alto, California. The scene from this week's Massacre Theater is from Super 8. The tie-in is that 8 is the average number of films Adam tries to fit into his top 5.
Now, to be fair, you only had 6 last show.
How dare you. And Rescue Don and Little Dieter are a pair. They cannot be separated, Scott. I take great offense at that. We also heard from Taylor C. with more connections.
The connection, of course, being both Super 8 and The Impossible's creative debt to Steven Spielberg. Though due to Spielberg's active production role in Super 8, I doubt he would have asked J.J. Abrams if he has no sense of decency, much as Adam imagined he would have asked Bayona. I would have hoped Adam would have done a more exaggerated Kyle Chandler, and Josh didn't quite scream, "She's nice to me," in the almost comically overwrought way that Joel Courtney delivers that line in Super 8.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we missed an opportunity, but I think back on my review of Super 8, a film I was a big fan of, and that was my favorite scene in the movie.
Okay.
I love that confrontation between the father and son. I was really moved by it. I thought what Joel Courtney was doing was perfect. So
I wasn't able to engineer any sort of reverse puberty, I'm afraid. So
no.
To pull that off.
You did try nicely. Finally, Alexa in Princeton, New Jersey writes in, "It is also a survivor movie like The Impossible and in multiple ways. Not only is the town trying to survive the rampage of an angry escaped alien, but Joe and his father are trying to survive the catastrophic impact of the mother's death. The film also mirrors The Impossible in that Joe and his father find a way to reconnect and see each other in a new light, just like Lucas and his mother. I think you've inspired me to go home and watch Super 8 for the 10th time. If quote-unquote Spielbergian is wrong, then I don't want to be right," Alexa says. So how about that? A film that, again, we thought had no connections to our discussion of The Impossible or any part of our show last week, and it turns out that obviously they're absolutely right. It's a survival movie. It's a parent and child movie. There's a lot going on.
Listeners
there.
Are just much smarter than us.
Or they are.
They have a lot more time on their hands.
Well, in the Spielbergian thing, too, we should point out that when we decided to do Super 8 for the scene, that was before you had written your intro.
It's true. I know.
Impossible.
We can't claim like that was all planned out. I know.
No, it really wasn't at all. But if you want to hear that scene from Super 8 and our review of The Impossible, it was a great fight. We also shared our top 5 survival movies. That show is available at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. Josh, why don't you reach in to the brimming Film Spotting hat? Not as many entries as on Golden Pond, I'll have you know. But quite a few.
That's surprising to me, actually. I would have thought Super 8 would have gotten a lot more than on Golden Pond.
Maybe your Hepburn was just that much better than your Joel
Courtney. That's probably it.
Reach into the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
That would be Matt Lawson from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Congratulations, Matt. Email feedback@filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
I've worked with a lot of directors, Lloyd. Some of them were geniuses, some of them were bastards, but I've never met one who was so totally and absolutely, I don't know.
Thank you, Gary. I'm very touched. Now, will you get up the stage?
That theme music means it's time for this week's edition of Massacre Theater. Two quick housekeeping bits first. Josh, where was Matt Lawson from? Say that again.
Raleigh,
North Carolina.
Oregon, Oregon, whatever.
Same difference. We also got a great email this past week, Josh, that I felt like this was the best point in the show to share it, from Christopher in Minneapolis, who caught something that we were totally oblivious to, once again, with a Massacre Theater connection. This goes back to our live show from a few weeks ago that we had here in Chicago at Main Stage. We announced our winner of that Massacre Theater was a listener named Ben, and where he hails from has a connection to that particular scene, as pointed out here by Christopher. Why don't you read it?
I couldn't help notice a very peculiar and fascinating instance of movie-inspired synchronicity during a recent show, and I'm wondering if I might just be the only listener out there in the entire world of film-spotting fans who actually caught it. It involves the classic 1968 film Planet of the Apes, one of my faves. It just so happens that Massacre Theater winner Ben is from Fort Wayne, Indiana. Well, if you go to the scene in the film between Taylor, Zira, and Cornelius, where Taylor folds a piece of paper into an airplane, I think it's right before the big courtroom scene, Cornelius asks Taylor where he learned to do this, as in read and write, I guess. Heston scribbles his answer down on another piece of paper that Zira reads aloud, Fort Wayne, Indiana. So, pretty sweet, huh? I'm sure I'm the only one who cares about this sort of thing, but I have to say that not only do I love the synchronicity, but I notice them all the time. What can I say, guys? I'm tapped into the mysterious powers of the cosmos. Love the show.
I think maybe Christopher needs to be our in-house psychic.
Yes, I would like that. We've been needing one.
Let's put him to work. But how about that? Of course, we did not make that connection.
Kind of creepy.
It is true that that scene that Ben won was a scene that references Fort Wayne, Indiana, where he is from. There is something crazy going on with Massacre Theater and film spotting, and we thank Christopher for pointing it out. Let's get from the synchronicity to the bad acting. Massacre Theater is presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
Help support the show by signing up now. Film spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
So I think with this scene, we're going to set up, if you listen to the entire show, you should see a connection.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've noted here, listeners will probably find 7 or 8 that we didn't think of. And the only note about the text that we do feel the need to point out is that you're going to hear me at one point say the word blank. Blank is not in the original script. It is not in the movie. But there are two words there we just had to take.
Yeah, they would have been clear giveaways.
Made it way, way, way too obvious. But without those two words, I think this one could still be a little bit of a challenge, Josh. I'm going to start it off. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Give me the action.
And action.
I'm just doing what I know. I'm doing what you taught me.
I never taught you to be a thief.
No, you taught me to navigate blank. But after what happened, there weren't a whole lot of legitimate ways for me to use that skill.
What are you doing here?
I think I found a way home. It's a job for some very, very powerful people. People who I believe can fix my chargers permanently. But I need your help.
You're here to corrupt one of my brightest and best.
No, you know what I'm offering. You have to let them decide for themselves.
Money.
Not just money. You remember.
And scene.
Oh, that's going in a 2-year anniversary montage.
Great,
Josh.
Great.
Well done. I can't wait to see who listeners think you were trying to impersonate there.
I doubt it'll be the person it's supposed to be.
Exactly. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, February 12th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Okay, shoot me. Go ahead. Kill me now.
I'm your retainer. It's against the code of the samurai to kill you.
Look, if you're my retainer, whatever the f*** that is, I do what I'm telling you and f***ing shoot me. What the hell did you do that for?
You told me to.
We get into our poll questions now, and Josh, you talked about Forrest Whitaker and how good he was in a very good, we both agreed, Jim Jarmusch film, Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai. And on our last show, we were looking ahead to our comeback theme for this week. Even though we're focused now on directors, we were thinking about actors and the Oscars and Oscar winners who have maybe fallen on hard times and are in need of a comeback themselves. So we simply wanted to know which former Oscar winner you'd most like to see make a comeback. We gave you these 5 options: Adrian Brody, Gina Davis, Hilary Swank, Mr. Forrest Whitaker, or Renee Zellweger. Josh, how did it come out?
Well, I'm glad I didn't go with Renee Zellweger. That's who I was considering. She only received 7% of the vote. That was followed up by Hilary Swank, who received 11% of the vote. Gina Davis got 15%. The person I did go with, Adrian Brody, came in second with 32% of the vote. But Mr. Whitaker did win, 35% of the vote.
I believe men do make up about 80% of our audience, but a little disappointing that the three bottom finishers were all.
Yeah, it did break down that way,
there,
didn't it?
And Gina Davis was my choice, only getting, though, 15% of the vote. We did get a few listener comments on this poll. We start with John Nordyke, who said, Forrest Whitaker, yeah, another ghost dog is in order, right? Although he was decent in Panic Room, so a detractor there on Forrest Whitaker and Ghost Dog, but John ultimately says, I yearn for more Hilary Swank.
Max O'Connell almost went my direction with Adrian Brody. He said Adrian Brody would be awfully close, but I believe one of my most frequently asked questions when I'm around friends is, what the hell happened to Gina Davis? The obvious answer is Cutthroat Island, but one flop shouldn't destroy the career of such a natural comedian. She's someone who brought a daffy lightness not only to her best comedic roles, Beetlejuice, Fletch, Quick Change, but also to some of her dramatic roles, bringing a much-needed element of levity to films that took on tragic levels. I'll always cherish the early His Girl Friday-esque scenes in The Fly and her effervescent charm throughout Thelma and Louise, and I only hope that we'll see her again in a decent movie someday. Those are a lot of titles,
yeah.
Actually, that I'd forgotten she was in. I know,
at my
but
Gina
look
Davis
at that.
Pick. And now Max makes apparently a better case than I did, because I see you coming over a little bit to my side. And I love that Max said that one of the most common questions that comes up when he's with his friends is whatever happened to Gina Davis. I mean, I'm thinking of Bill Murray and Stripes, Lee Harvey, I want to party with you. They sound like a crazy group of cats having that conversation. Thank you to everyone who voted in that poll question and who shared your feedback. That brings us to this week's poll question. And as we hinted, we are going to have a Valentine's theme to next week's show. We're talking about the decidedly unromantic looking new Steven Soderbergh film Side Effects. But in line with Valentine's Day, our top five is going to be romantic gestures. Romantic gestures on screen, and I'm looking forward to that, though I haven't remotely started crafting my list yet. For this week's poll, we were thinking about our favorite movie couples, and to make it a little easier, let's pull not from the entire history of cinema, but just from the last decade. Josh, their options are
Bob and Charlotte from Lost in Translation, Guy and Girl from Once, Jack and Ennis from Brokeback Mountain, Jesse and Celine from Before Sunset, Joel and Clementine, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, and then Noah and Allie from The Notebook, Adam's favorite. I'm sure that's one you watch every year around Valentine's Day.
Never seen it.
Wally and Eve from Wally.
And if you are so inclined to go against the options we gave you, we're sure we're leaving out some good ones there. You do have the ability to vote other and write in your candidate, and we'll share some of those on next week's show. Where are you going on this poll question, Josh? It's a tough one.
I want to say Jack and Ennis, but I don't know if you can say your favorite movie couple when it ends that tragically.
This
I mean, that's
is
a
it,
hard.
Right?
That's a hard
question.
Yeah, exactly. So I'll just go where everything ends up nice and rosy with Wally and Eve, I think.
Okay, that's fair enough. I was thinking along the exact same lines, where what defines what makes a great movie couple? Are you thinking about a couple that you really want to see together and you're happy at the end when they do come together? But some of our options, spoiler alert,
right,
that isn't the case. And you could even debate whether or not Bob and Charlotte in Lost in Translation are a quote-unquote couple. That's also maybe what makes them an interesting choice. So you can go a bunch of different ways here. And it's funny that you bring up Jack and Ennis, because as I was going through these options, I really thought I was probably going to go with Jesse and Celine from Before Sunset, my favorite film of the bunch there. And I do love those two characters. But really, for me, I was thinking about the couple that I was most heartbroken that they didn't end up together.
Most invested in.
Most
maybe.
Invested
yeah,
in.
Yeah.
Exactly. And with that, I think I'm going to go with Jack and Ennis from Brokeback Mountain.
Yeah, I can see
I
that.
I think that's the one that cut me the hardest. So we want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. Also at filmspotting.net, you can find our bonus content there. Click on our apps page, and that gives you all the information you need about getting the Film Spotting app for iPhone or Android. And we share every week some bonus content, a little bit of extra audio. And A couple weeks ago, Josh, we shared not only our top five most anticipated movies of 2013, but our top five most anticipated performances of 2013. Got some great feedback from listeners with some titles and some actors and actresses that we overlooked.
Some titles I hadn't heard of until we saw it. So.
Exactly. So I think that feedback will be very interesting. If you want to check that out, again, you can get that via the Film Spotting app. And a lot of people have written in, Josh, and said, I have the latest version of the app. There's an update. And ever since then, I haven't been able to find the bonus content.
Yeah, it's throwing people for a loop.
You're not alone. It was a listener who pointed out to me where the bonus content can now be found. And I'll just go ahead and say it here for all the folks listening who do consume the bonus content. If you've been wondering that yourself, there's an E for extra that's on the main screen. When you're looking at the rundown of the times and the show description, there's an E there. And if you click that, that's how you get to the extra content or the bonus content.
Little tech support here.
There you go. We also have a few more passes still left to give away for the new film directed by Dustin Hoffman, Quartet. It's playing here in Chicago at the Landmark. These are run-of-event passes, so you can use them anytime over the course of its run here in Chicago. Stars Maggie Smith, Michael Gambon, Tom Courtney, a murderer's row of British thespians. And all you have to do to enter is just email feedback at filmspotting.net, put Quartet in the subject line, and include your name and address, and you've got a shot at winning those passes. Finally, Josh, we mentioned about a month ago this event coming up, and now as we get closer, wanted to do a final plug for it. It's one I'm very excited about, something I'm going to be partaking in if my schedule allows, and right now I do have some dates penciled in. It's the 70 millimeter film festival that's taking place at the Music Box. The Master, if you missed it in 70 mil during its theatrical run, as I did, or if you want to see classics like 2001 in Vertigo on that huge Music Box screen in 70 millimeter. That festival starts February 15th and runs through the 28th.
I haven't chosen my title yet. I'm probably going to be able to get to one of these. I just don't know which one.
Yeah, Master for me is the one I have to see.
Yeah.
My favorite film of last year. And then after that, because I've lamented it so many times here on the show, I got to see 2001
on the big screen.
I just have to. Hopefully, we'll see some of you there if you decide to come out to the Music Box again. That's February 15th through the 28th. And for more information, go to the Music Box website. We'll also link to that info in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net.
You know who's on this boat?
No.
Maurice Chevalier, the movie actor. I just ran into him.
Did you write him?
No. How do you know it was Chevalier?
I got his passport.
Right there. Now, he can't get off the boat.
Hey, he looks like Chevalier.
Yes, he's a strong...
And I can look like Chevalier.
Well, I certainly look like Chevalier.
But that's not enough. You've got to sing one of Chevalier's songs to get off this boat.
If a nightingale could sing like you, they sing much better than you do.
And Dandy, you sing like that and they throw us all off the boat.
Well, let's try.
All right, come on.
Come on, let's go.
That was the Marx Brothers trying to get through customs in Monkey Business, the latest Marx Brothers film in our marathon, which got off to a bit of a bumpy start last show, Adam, with Animal Crackers. Now, these marathons are supposed to be our attempts to catch up with the grandmasters of cinema, or at least notable movements and genres. Mm-hmm. And then we're supposed to come away, for the most part, enriched. I found Animal Crackers mildly amusing, and you correct me if I have this wrong, no longer like animals or crackers.
That pretty much sums it up.
Okay, good. You did have one major problem with the movie. That it wasn't really a movie, but an awkwardly filmed version of one of the brothers' Broadway musical comedies. Monkey Business, in which Groucho, Chico, Harpo, and Zeppo are stowaways on a luxury cruise liner, opens up considerably, I'd say. In fact, as I watched it in preparation for this discussion, it struck me during the opening scene that there was even a bit of camera movement.
There was.
As we come in on a close-up of the four brothers stuck in barrels, I immediately thought of you. So I'm curious, did Monkey Business have enough cinematic ambition to qualify for you as a movie? Perhaps even one that may make you a bit more enthusiastic about the Marx Brothers.
I am happy to report, very happy to report, for my sake, having two films left to go in this marathon, and for the sake of our listeners, having to listen to us talk about two more films, that Monkey Business did in fact alleviate a lot of my concerns.
Good.
Particularly about the staginess issue. I really, really like this film. And I think that's because it's simply a much more sophisticated, better directed, better acted, and funnier movie than Animal Crackers. And it's not even close. I'd argue that even if someone out there prefers some of the gags in Animal Crackers, and that's fine, there are some really memorable, legendary Groucho Marx in particular bits in Animal Crackers. I can see that argument if you feel that way. But as movies, they're night and day as far as I'm concerned. And this is where, Josh, I really wish that I'd had more time to research the Marx Brothers more and knew more about them and their collaborators, because it's such a step ahead from Animal Crackers that I can't believe it came out only 1 year later. Is it simply because you've got a more skilled director in Norman Z. McLeod over Victor Herman? Or were the Marx Brothers themselves just becoming better cinematic performers and gag writers? Or was it that this was their first film that didn't start as a stage act and they had to conceive it as a piece of cinema? Or was it just developments in movie making, even though it was over the course of only 1 year? Were there enough changes in how movies were being made that made this a better production? I don't know. Probably a combination of all four. And yes, I certainly noticed that camera shot at the beginning where it tracks forward and we get a close-up. And I thought, wow, some camera movement. That was offset a little bit by the fact that I recognize that most of this film is going to take place on this ocean liner. So I immediately thought, oh, is this going to be like the mansion in Animal Crackers?
They did a lot with the space of the ocean liner.
Right.
Yeah.
But my immediate concern was, are we going to be confined in this space, mm-hmm. no matter how expansive mm-hmm. it is? But there's a key difference, and that is in how they use the entire space. They do go to all parts of the boat, and they use the camera to not just capture gags, but to actually make the gags work. There are some gags, and I'll get to one here, that don't work at all without the camera. They simply couldn't be pulled off on a stage. They had to be visual in that way. And where I really knew I was in good hands was about 5 minutes in when the Marx Brothers, as the stowaways, are being chased throughout the boat. And the action is really smooth in how it's shot and edited. But when I knew I was absolutely in good hands was about 35 minutes in during the sequence where Harpo and Chico are serving as bodyguards for Joe Helton. It's a 90-second sequence where they keep getting distracted, especially by women, and then end up following the wrong guy, but they're dressed all kind of the same, so they think they're still following the bodyguard. And that only works because of the way the camera pans and the way those scenes are edited to produce a comedic effect. So that's where I really felt like, okay, the Marx Brothers know what they're doing, not just on a stage, not just on a theatrical stage, but they can make movies too.
Yeah, that's certainly a gag that does depend on the camera and the editing. Like you said, it's much more open than anything we see in Animal Crackers. And so I did appreciate for that. I'm going to counter a little bit, though, is I don't think it's as drastically different as you're making it out to be. And I actually did enjoy Animal Crackers enough, and I enjoyed this about at the same level, I would say. While appreciating the openness that it gave, there was still that whole final section once we leave the boat, where not only do we go back, we travel to a house party, which is essentially where Animal Crackers takes place.
And it's rushed.
And it's rushed, and we're pretty much back in that confined space. And I'd also argue the laughs really die out. The climax of this film, which involves a fist fight between Zeppo and some hastily arranged villain, that just goes on and on. And Groucho, I'd argue, is kind of struggling for laughs there because it goes on so long, and they cut to him, and he'll try to throw in a one-liner that doesn't really work. That whole final third was pretty weak to me, mm-hmm. but because of the strength of the first half of the movie, or even a little bit more of that, I'd agree. This is an enjoyable film. There are just some great moments. We had a little bit of clip of the Chevalier bit, and that continues later where they actually try to pass themselves off as Chevalier by singing like he does.
Yeah, this picture doesn't look like you.
I know it don't look like me from the front, but you go in the back of the boat just like me.
You're not Maurice Chevalier.
Are you Maurice Chevalier?
No.
Well, there you are. Wait, I prove it. If a nightingale sing like you, sing much better than you do. And
get out.
Hey, no pushing.
Get out of here. Get back to where you belong. Passport. Then this picture doesn't look like you.
Well, it doesn't look like you either.
My favorite part of that is that they're all in a line, and they do it one after the other to the customs officer.
Hey, are you going to identify yourself or else?
If a nightingale would sing like you, they sing much sweeter than they do. You caught a new kind of love.
Out! Back from where you belong.
So just the idiocy of that and the way they handle it is brilliant. So, yeah, there are some much stronger bits in here than Animal Crackers, but I didn't find it to be this completely cohesive film that you did.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the second film in our Marx Brothers marathon, Monkey Business. I'm with you that the last third or so of the film definitely feels a bit compressed. It feels a bit rushed. The laughs do die down a little bit, but I'll disagree with you on what you were saying about Groucho in that final boxing scene, just because he turns it into a boxing boxing match like an announcer. And I actually thought some of his one-liners were pretty funny.
Straining to do that, though.
It's straining a little bit, but I loved what the camera was doing there, too, where all of a sudden he'll say a line in one place of the barn, and then we'll cut to a little bit of the fighting, and the next thing you know, he's doing the announcing from way up in the corner somewhere. And something about that getting an overhead view I thought was very funny, and I just sort of like the ambition, if you will, of them using the camera in that way. But I'm surprised you didn't see as much of a shift as I did here, just because not only did they use the camera a lot more, but there was none of that dead space that we saw in Animal Crackers. None of those awkward pauses after a line as if Groucho was waiting for the people behind him to applaud. This clips by because of the editing, because of the acting, at a screwball comedy pace. Everything about how they cut to close-ups or cut to medium shots is just, as I said, more sophisticated and I think more effective.
Well, and I'll agree, one thing that emphasizes is the interplay, which was a problem I had with Animal Crackers, is that there wasn't a lot of interplay between Groucho and whoever was supposed to be his straight man, or even the brothers. The opening scene in the barrels, that was a relief to me right away, is in the way they interacted with each other and played off each other in ways that they didn't very much in Animal Crackers. Let me get to something that also will speak to a little bit of my reservations with the Marx Brothers still. And it was actually posed either on the Film Spotting Forum or it may have been an email of why we haven't talked about Harpo. And I didn't really want to get into it in Animal Crackers because it was tied to my theory with this whole marathon. I really wanted to give it a chance. And I had almost an allergic reaction to Harpo in Animal Crackers. And I've got to say, it only worsened here.
It's not funny watching him chase women around?
Well, we get a lot of that, and okay, if that's, you know, a recurring gag, fine. But there's something about this guy that people have these visceral reactions. A lot of times you hear about it with early Jim Carrey, where for whatever unexplained reason, you just see them on screen and you kind of recoil. That's what it's been for me. And in Monkey Business, it got to the point when he's pretending to be one of the puppets. There's like a Punch and Judy show.
You mean the best sequence in the film?
Oh, no.
The best Marx Brothers sequence we've seen yet?
The Chevalier is the best sequence yet.
No,
when Harpo is trying to pass himself off as a puppet, he pulls some sort of face where he crosses his eyes, puffs out his cheeks. You complained about the repeated faces of Dumont in Animal Crackers. This is the face Harpo goes to all the time. And I'm going to be honest with you, this is not a good, bad evaluation. That face makes me physically angry. It doesn't make me angry at Harpo. It's because I know he's supposed to be an irritant, and it's not that he's making me angry and I want to go after him. It just makes me like angry to have to see it and to see him pull it. I can't explain it. It's just, I've got a real problem with Harpo that I don't know if any of these films are going to help me overcome.
You don't want to see Josh watching Harpo Marx. You wouldn't like Josh watching Harpo Marx. Wow.
You didn't get that at all. Do you find him funny?
Let me say this. I can't say yet that I love Harpo Marx or that I have a deep affection for him. I certainly didn't after watching Animal Crackers, but I'm a lot closer to it after watching Monkey Business.
Really?
Because of two things you specifically said. The Chevalier sequence, that's so brilliant, not just because
he's good in that.
But the punchline is the payoff of seeing Harpo after watching his brothers come up and sing like Chevalier. Of course, he doesn't speak, so he comes up and is lip syncing, and he's got a photograph playing a Chevalier record on his back. That's genius. That sequence is classic, and I loved it. But I love the puppet sequence.
Oh.
And I don't know what you're saying about the face, only because unlike Dumont, who makes the same face throughout the entire film, that's isolated to that sequence. He makes that particular puppet face in that sequence.
About 40 times.
Okay, but that made me laugh out loud. That whole thing where he did actually look physically like a puppet to me, I thought that was hilarious.
I think he makes it in other places in the movie, or maybe it's just a variation on that face.
I love the puppet sequence, and I like that you brought up the interplay, because that was another big reason for me why this movie works so much more effectively than Animal Crackers, where, as we talk about Margaret Dumont, and I know a lot of people out there love her, but there was just this imbalance where you had Groucho being so heavily insult-based, and we still get some of that in this film. And we have Margaret Dumont reacting in a very unnatural vaudeville kind of way, just making these exaggerated faces at the audience. Here, actors actually respond like actors in a movie should, like they're actually listening to what the other person is saying, even if it's something a little bit ridiculous coming out of Groucho Marx's mouth. And I think that the lack of insult-based humor is a big part of that. He actually says things sometimes that you can see people responding to and not just recoiling the way Margaret Dumont does. So that was another big strength of this movie for me. And you're right, as we said, as the movie goes on and we get to that last third, there are still a lot of plot activity and a lot of bits that don't really pay off in a narrative sense. It's still really about just setting up these sequences and these big gags and musical numbers in some cases more than anything else. But I do like watching Harpo play the harp. I'm pretty impressed by that, Josh.
As long as he's not making a face, he can play the harp all he wants.
Here he makes faces while he plays the harp, so it's perfect for me.
Of course he does.
Yeah. Chico playing the piano is fun. And just in general, I thought the story and the script was much more streamlined. I liked, for example, the concept they came up with of having these rival gangsters on this boat being protected by different sets of brothers. I thought that paid off, especially in that sequence I mentioned where they're supposed to be protecting him and keep getting distracted.
Yeah, I think the plot here does allow for that one good sequence, but it also does get to be a problem. It has a lot to do with the unwieldiness of that final third.
A couple more bits I do want to point out, and I'd love to hear as we go through this marathon, when we talk about these films, I'm sure listeners who have seen these movies or are watching along with us have their favorite scenes that stand out. We've touched on two of them that I think most people love, not only the Chevalier, but the puppet show. There are other minor little moments that I really love, touches that I didn't see, more subtle touches that I didn't see in Animal Crackers, like the bit with Zeppo Marx early in the film, where he's walking along and he's kind of hitting on one of the gangster's daughters. And he keeps dropping his handkerchief so she'll notice. And then she drops her handkerchief and says, "Does this belong to you?" And there's just a great symmetry to that, a nice meet cute between them there that I thought was very effective. And there's a bit with your guy Harpo. You probably hated it then, where he finds a frog, a pet frog, that he keeps putting under his hat. And I realized later that that whole sequence was probably constructed just to have the joke pay off later when someone says, "I have a frog in my throat."
Oh, yeah.
And he's looking for his pet frog who's missing.
Yeah, so totally.
He starts shaking the guy upside and down and is hitting him
around
because his frog is in his mouth. That was funny, Josh.
I liked that scene. And here's why there may be hope for me with Harpo is because I do recognize that he's the one. We've talked already about anarchy. That's the word that's often used for the Marx brothers. And he's the one where the anarchy has a dangerous feel because he's on the verge of inflicting real violence a couple of times in this movie. Not comic violence, real violence. And that is one of the scenes. He completely turns the guy upside down. Harpo's good there.
All right. Well, I'm glad you threw him a little bone there. That's Monkey Business, the second film in our Marx Brothers marathon. We'll get to Duck Soup next week, and after that is A Night at the Opera. And that's it for the marathon, though we'll get to our awards, where I have a feeling Harpo Marx is not going to win Best Supporting Actor for Josh.
A couple films yet.
Point.
There might be a chance.
Two films left. And we should note that Michael Phillips, who is much more of a Marx Brothers aficionado than us, is going to be on for that fourth Marx Brothers movie. So he's going to talk about A Night at the Opera with us, and he's going to share his awards as well because he's seen all these movies already. So Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune on here in a couple weeks should be a lot of fun.
After a shot of Tiger Blood, Adam and I should be ready to review Charlie Sheen in A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan III. Then if we have any strength left, we'll finish our list of the top five directors who need a comeback. Stay with us.
A glimpse inside of my ever-loving life. Something pulls at me, I don't know why. A glimpse inside of the things you meant to hide. Something really reaches out to find. What you thought was make-believe, the dream you left incomplete. There's nothing to fear, there's nobody here. Oh, and I'm gonna see my land close inside of the things you've been denied. So
thank you time here on the show. We'll get to your donations and a few of your comments as we do like to take a moment every week, Josh, to thank everyone who threw some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. We do have a couple quick notes we want to get to first. The music we want to mention, as we usually do here in this part of the show, we got a note from Andy Rosenstein in Chicago, and he said that he heard our preview of our discussion this week of the new Roman Coppola movie, A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charlie Swan III, and he knew he had to write us. He writes, "I haven't seen the film yet, but I have heard the soundtrack, and I think it bears a mention. The music was composed by one of Chicago's unsung master songwriters and a true character, Mr. Liam Hayes. It is an astonishing mashup of styles and sounds and shows a degree of musicality and care rarely heard in film music. The soundtrack was recorded and co-produced by Pat Sansone of Wilco / Autumn Defense and Josh Shapira, two more relatively unsung Chicago talents."
Well, you know the music is good because the movie leans on it a lot.
It does.
Did you notice that?
Yeah, yeah. And we'll get to more on that film here in a moment on the show, but we did think the music stood out. And when Andy's email came in, I had just seen the film, and it just seemed to make perfect sense that we should feature Liam Hayes, especially being a Chicago guy, this week on the show. So thank you, Andy, for that note. Also want to throw a quick plug to MoviePass, our partner with that great product where you can use the app on your iPhone or Android phone and your MoviePass card and get unlimited movies for a flat monthly rate in theaters nationwide. All you got to do is go to moviepass.com/filmspotting and use the offer code filmspotting, and you'll get $10 off your first month of subscription. Again, that's moviepass.com/filmspotting and offer code filmspotting. I use mine all the time, and I think a lot of our listeners really would get a lot of use out of it as well.
We also want to plug the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. Jeff's latest podcast has the Oscar Screenwriting Nominees Panel, and he's going to be featuring 7 of the 10 nominated films, including Beasts of the Southern Wild with co-writer Lucy Alibar and co-writer-director Ben Zeitlin. He'll have Flight's John Gatens, Life of Pi's David McGee, Lincoln's Tony Kushner, Moonrise Kingdom's Roman Coppola, Silver Lining Playbook's David O. Russell, and Zero Dark Thirty's Mark Boal. That is a lineup.
That is a lineup, and it sounds like a great show. If you dig filmmaker interviews backstory, this is Jeff's iPad app issue 04, launched recently on the iPad. Each issue is filled with filmmaker interviews, full-length scripts, short films, and more. There are a lot of fans out there, I know, of Usual Suspects writer Christopher McQuarrie, and Backstory publishes the first act of his unproduced World War II air raid movie, The Last Mission. If you want to find it, just type Backstory into the iPad app store to download the first issue for free. For a limited time, you can get more information at backstory.net. And if you do want to find the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith, we put a link in the notes for this show at filmspotting.net, or just do a search in iTunes. Let's go ahead and get to our thank yous now. We only have one kind of long note this week, but some great comments from our listeners who we do sincerely want to thank and share our gratitude for everything they give to the show. We start with two platinum-level donors.
Nice.
Ralph Kaiser in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
"These days, film critique seems to have devolved to simple star ratings and one-sentence reviews that are designed to be severely polarizing. I always look forward to listening to your thoughtful discussions on films. Not only do they help broaden my knowledge of film in general, but they often give me a different viewpoint or a different insight into films that I've already seen. I forwarded a few credits your way to help keep you broadcasting, but most of all, I wanted to thank you for your time week after week, year after year. Anything that you sink that much time into is either a job or a calling. I hope it's the latter for you. Keep up the good work."
Thank you very much, Ralph, for your generosity and for those comments.
Yeah, I think this note came in just in time because I was about to propose a rating system based on Coke cans, 1 to 4 Coke cans.
I love it.
And, you know, we'll
see. If we could get Coke on board as a sponsor.
That'd be even
better.
Completely
sell out.
Let's try it.
I'm all for it. We wouldn't need to have our listeners donate anymore.
Well, Let's not say that.
We also got a platinum level donation from Rohit, longtime listener, I hope I'm saying that right, in Stockport, UK.
"As it's been over 2 years since my last donation, here is £1 per show as thanks for all the great recommendations. I've just watched Girl Walk all day, and it has blown away the winter blues."
The interesting part of that is I think Rohit's donation actually could have financed Girl Walk all day.
Yeah, probably.
So, maybe you should give that money to the filmmakers next time. Thank you for that. A new $10 a month subscriber, that's Toby in Albion, California. And Josh, since I know you love it, you just love it so much when I talk about geography, especially my home state, Iowa, I have to note, I feel compelled to note that there's an Albion, Iowa.
Is there an Albion, Iowa?
Small little town.
You know, when you read Albion, California, the first thing I thought of is, I wonder if there's an Albion, Iowa.
Yeah, I bet there's a pizza ranch there,
too. Thanks for sharing. I'm sure there is.
Your favorite restaurant. New $5, and now we lost the pizza ranch sponsorship. New $5 a month donors. We have four $5 a month donors to thank.
Jerry from Ottawa. Neil from Inverness Highland, UK.
Greg from Roseville, Minnesota, and Josh from Chicago.
It's not Josh Larson. He says, I have no excuse for how long it took to become a monthly donor. I've been a loyal listener since 2010. When you see a movie with someone, what happens as soon as you leave the theater? You look at each other and say, what did you think? It seems to be such a simple idea, but as your show has shown, it's anything but simple. To all the debates to come, I say long live Film Spotting.
Nice. Yeah, that couldn't have been me, because I've only been a listener since about 2011, November.
January of last year. A new Bucca Show donor, John, in Ashland, Oregon. And we also want to thank this week Christopher in Mill Valley, California. That brings us to our final donor we want to thank this week. A longtime listener. This name is very familiar. He's a gold-level donor and has a great little story here. Alex Renaravello, here in Chicago.
This donation has been a long time coming, but there's a good reason. I'm a writer-director from Los Angeles, and a few years back, I achieved one of my life goals, to write and direct my very own feature film. It was a romantic comedy called Alpha Males, in the vein of Swingers and Brothers McMullen, and it was made in the same manner, with only a little money, but a lot of passion. During editing, I would take breaks every few hours and go for walks and listen to my iPod.
I prefer podcasts, and I somehow came across yours because you were reviewing a film I wanted to see. I downloaded it and have been an avid listener ever since. I decided then that I would make my first donation when Alpha Males was released. I finished Alpha Males and took it on the festival circuit. It was extremely well received and was even named one of the top 10 films to make you laugh by Best of Fest. To make a long story short, when I tried to sell it, I was told it needed more sound and color work. I was still learning. The problem was that I had no money left. My heart sank. I knew it was going to be a long time before it would ever get distributed. Cut to 3 years later, I've already directed two other films, and Alpha Males is finally seeing the light of day. It's coming out on DVD February 12th and will be available on Netflix and iTunes. I hope to one day have the honor of having one of my films ripped to shreds on your show.
Well, if he wants that, not to give away our review of Charles Swan, but maybe he should cast Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, that would help him get that review, certainly. Thank you, Alex, for sharing your story. We wish you all the best of luck with Alpha Males and all your future projects.
What you thought was make-believe, the dream you left incomplete, there's nothing to fear, there's nobody.
Hi, this is Todd Haynes, the director of I'm Not There, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
You're a big, fake liar.
You're incredibly irresponsible.
You don't listen.
You're crazy. You're selfish. You're not the only person, Charles.
I thought it was different with her. But then, poof.
I don't want to be with you anymore.
I can't concentrate. I think of her every minute.
Whoa. Zing. Rewind. What did you do?
She said she didn't want to be in the drawer with all the other girls.
Well, obviously, I totally agree with that. I'm lost. I have no idea what we're talking about.
You're listening to Film Spotting and the sounds there of part of the trailer for the new film, A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan. The third, it's the movie that inspired this week's top five here on the show. Directors who need a comeback. We've shared three of our picks, Josh, and we'll get to our top two here in a moment. But we do want to start with Charles Swan, which is available now on iTunes and playing in select cities. It marks Charlie Sheen's first lead role in a movie since Tiger Blood and Winning attach themselves to the zeitgeist much in the same way, appropriately, most STDs develop. Or so I've read, Josh. It also marks Roman Coppola's first feature film as a director since his debut, CQ, which was all the way back in 2001. So I'm asking you to indulge me here for a second and allow me to share the first couple of sentences of Charles Swan's official synopsis, because it will help me get to my setup question for you. Set in a stylized Los Angeles, A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan III is a playful comedy of lost love, friendship, revenge fantasies, and Brandy Alexanders. Charles Sheen is a successful graphic designer whose fame, money, and charm have provided him with a seemingly perfect life. When his true love, a perplexing beauty named Ivana, suddenly breaks off their relationship, Charlie's life falls apart and he swirls into a downward spiral of doubt, confusion, and reflection. If we play a little Mad Libs and replace L.A. with Rome, Brandy Alexanders with champagne, Charles with Guido, graphic designer with movie director, and Ivana with Louisa, you've pretty much got the synopsis for 8.5. Charles and Fellini's Guido are such fundamentally dishonest men and so crippled by their own neuroses and guilt that they're incapable of making a decision, creative or otherwise. It's probably worth noting here, Josh, that CQ was a movie about a filmmaker with his own set of artistic and relationship issues, and that Coppola cited 8.5 as a major influence. But there's one other movie I couldn't help thinking about as I watched Charles Swan, and I know you don't see this one coming, Josh, so I look forward to your reaction. If I was pitching this project, player style, to a Hollywood exec, I'd best describe it as 8.5 meets Casa de Mi Padre.
Well, I'm starting to think you didn't like the movie, Adam.
Maybe it was the scene where Sheen and his best buddy Kirby, played by Jason Schwartzman, go for a ride on their horses like cowboys, even though it seems to be clearly on some kind of soundstage and maybe some rear projection involved. But throughout it, Swan exhibits the same kind of esoteric, absurd brand of comedy you love so much in Casa de Mi Padre. So with those two movies in mind, were you also able to appreciate Charles Swan? And does this comeback have you wanting to see what's next for either Coppola or Sheen, both or neither?
Wow, you are doing a real disservice to Casa de Mi Padre to compare it to this. It's not the same brand of humor at
so
all.
You didn't like it.
There's very little humor in here at all. I mean, what they do go for falls completely flat, and often it's in these fantasy sequences we get inside Charles Swan's mind. It was kind of frustrating to watch this movie because I do like CQ. I know some people absolutely love it. And I was hoping for something equally as interesting from Coppola. I don't see this launching him towards any sort of comeback. And as for Sheen, did you use the word charm in the plot description, or the marketing used it?
Yeah, I don't think I used the word charm.
Okay, okay. I thought I heard that in the plot description, and that is the real problem here, because as that describes, you're supposed to believe the key to this film is believing that this guy, Charles Swan, has a modicum of charm. Now, he's hitting rock bottom, so of course we're going to see him not being successful right away, but you're supposed to detect a little bit, just a little bit of what that charm might have been when he was on his rise. And Sheen has no screen presence here. It's not that he's playing an unlikable guy or a down on his luck guy. Plenty of movies have been able to make that interesting, but he has nothing to offer. It almost seems as if he's physically struggling in a lot of these scenes. Part of that may be because he wears these dark sunglasses for pretty much the entirety of the movie. We're shut off from his eyes. I mean, the impression I got was almost of a geriatric presence is what he brings to this film, which doesn't fit the story at all. I mean, this guy is supposed to be a rascal, sort of a devil-may-care guy who is sleazy, but yeah, you can see how people come around to his side. I never saw that at all. And an example within the film that really made it stand out was the presence of Bill Murray. You might say it's the movie's saving grace, or you could say it shows us exactly what the movie should have been. He plays Charles Swan's business manager, and he's also a guy who's a little bit down on his luck, or at least in one of the scenes, Murray describes some marital problems he's having. And he makes this sort of desperation so interesting in the way that Murray often does.
Yeah.
I wanted to be in that character's head, not Charles Swan's.
You hit?
No, but I think I might have pulled a muscle. You got a gun?
No, I thought you did.
Shit, no gun. Guess we're gonna have to lasso. Stupid lasso. We're outnumbered. These women are really on a warpath.
Well, partner, you can dig a hole and crawl into it, or you can face them like a man.
Are you a man?
Of course I am.
Show me.
You're right. Bill Murray's one of our greatest gifts on screen, and he does bring that presence even in his few scenes here in Charles Swan. One of them, too, I think about is a sequence that really is not that charming, certainly, and really not that interesting, where it's one of the fantasies they have where it's like a spy sequence and it's the secret society of ball busters and Bill Murray heads it up.
And it goes on forever.
Yeah, it goes on forever. But Bill Murray's really funny in that sequence. They're in the back of a car and he's sort of explaining to them what's going on. And I was really into it because I was watching Bill Murray and he somehow sold it. I'm with you on this film overall. I think maybe you didn't like it even a little more strongly than I didn't. But I think my biggest problem is just that the whole thing is a lark. It's a curio, but it just seems like, even though it's dealing with this sort of heady subject matter in terms of this identity crisis and this relationship crisis and asking some of these existential questions, it just seems like a good time that Roman Coppola is trying to have. It's weightless. I think that's the right word. And I think that Charlie Sheen's performance, I'm with you, doesn't really do it any favors. I can see the charm there a little bit more than you, but I just think there's no depth there. There's no life. There's nothing behind the surface that makes him someone I want to follow for an entire film. I think that's my biggest problem with the Charles Swan character.
That's interesting they use the word lark, because what I felt is on the outside looking in of this movie right away, I don't know what it was, but somehow I got the sense that this film was probably fun to make, that the people behind it had a fun time making it. They were happy with the results, but I sensed that all from the outside, if that makes any sense. I was never invested in it or got a sense that this was made for an audience, maybe? Does that make sense?
That's
it was
what
almost
I mean
made
by a lark.
Yeah. It was like it was made to be shown at the rap party, and that was it.
And I think you see that at the ending of the film.
The final shot, yeah.
We get this party on the beach, and Charlie Sheen comes out and says, "I'm Charlie Sheen playing Charles Swan," and Liam Hayes, the music is great in the film, probably the best aspect of the film. He's playing a song, and you see Roman Coppola, and we get this little riff maybe on the ending of Medium Cool, where the guy behind the camera ends up being on camera. But that really is all this is. It's a conglomeration of movie references. There's James Cagney and the old cars and the old technology that comes up a lot in the film.
Was this supposed to be set in the 70s or something? Did you ever get a sense of?
No, I thought it was set in the present day.
Present, maybe, but had all this retro stuff.
Right. It's just retro stuff. It's part of the feel they're going for with the film. It didn't add up to much. And I think for me as well, one of the bigger problems, Josh, is with everything surrounding the character Ivana, the woman who is apparently the one he loves that's causing him so much misery. We only really get a sense of her from the flashbacks and what he says about her. And that's the whole conceit of the film. Don't get me wrong, I get it. It's going to be a case where we see her in an imperfect way, and it's biased and incomplete because it's only what he is choosing to share with us as the narrator of the story. But when the whole film revolves around his heartbreak and his need to reconcile and how he's still in love with her, I feel like you either have to make a more fully developed character that we actually understand the nature of their relationship in an interesting way, or go the other way completely, almost like the movie Swingers, where the whole film is about Jon Favreau's character's heartbreak and we never see her. We hear her voice at one point. But just having the glimpses of her we do only makes her less satisfying.
I think that's a real separation from CQ as well, because what I found in that film was that both of the female characters I thought were pretty well developed and really had some impact on the main male protagonist's story in a way that it doesn't happen at all here. But Angela Lindvall, who played the actress playing the movie spy, I thought she was really good. And the girlfriend of Jeremy Davies' filmmaker character, Elodie Boucher, I believe is her name, she was very strong, too, in a number of supporting scenes. She didn't get a lot of time, but she had more presence in that film than the main female character does here.
I will say that I think the final scene with Charlie and Ivana and their characters, I think is effective. And I thought it was fairly touching, at least as touching as this film could get. So I thought that sequence did work. I do want to single out two other things that worked about it before we just end this by completely railing on this film. There are two moments that stand out for me as moments or sequences that show me that Roman Coppola does have something I think can be harnessed, and he's definitely someone who I think can make good to great films. There's one line of dialogue where Charlie Sheen has just survived what he thinks is a real scare. He thinks he may have died. Turns out he didn't really, or wasn't that close. But he's recovering in his hospital room, and his sister, played by Patricia Arquette, comes to see him, and then she's leaving with Charlie's nephews, and he gives her a hug. And it's clear that there's some friction between them, and they were probably never really the closest, but they tolerate each other. And he has a great line of dialogue. He says, "I don't get to see you and the kids as much." And then there's just a little bit of pause, and they go their separate ways. And I love it because you know it was left there hanging at the end. What he meant to say was, "I don't get to see you and the kids as much as I'd like."
Sure.
But he can't say that.
Yeah.
Because it's not true. And I thought that was a brilliant little line of dialogue that shows a lot about him and that relationship.
It probably could have, but with Sheen there, he just doesn't sell it for me. But I'll quote another line that I did like, and Coppola did do the screenplay as well. It goes back to Murray, and maybe it was just his delivery. Maybe the lines are all equally good. You need the right actor to deliver them. But at one point, he just says, "Desire is about as close to happiness as I'm going to get." And that speaks to that supporting character's experience. It could very well also speak to Charles Swan's. It probably does for the film. I thought that was a really nice moment. Could have used a lot more of them.
Yeah, could have. The last one I'll mention, though, is the phone conversation that Charlie Sheen has at one point where he's talking to the sister of Ivana about Ivana wanting to come back and get her ski equipment and some of the stuff she left. And Charlie Sheen starts out in that conversation in a very sort of placid, serene way, and he's just going to have a nice conversation. And then as it goes on, he becomes more and more animated and angry. And there's just something very quirky and absurd but effective for me in the way Coppola stages it, where he's got two chairs and at one point he can't light a lighter in one chair, but then he goes to the other chair and he can perfectly light a lighter. It almost seems as if those two chairs represent the split in his personality. And when he sits in one, he acts in a different way. And those types of sequences where people are talking on a phone, it's clearly a one-way conversation. The other person really isn't there. Even great actors sometimes sound really phony doing that and unnatural. That was a real moment for me. That was a real sequence where not only what the camera was doing, but what Sheen was doing, where it really came through. And it's funny because it ends with Sheen's character saying, "This is the worst phone conversation I've ever had." And I thought it was one of the best sequences in the film. Charles Swan III is out, as we said, on demand. You can get it via iTunes. You can order it there, or you can also find it in theaters in select cities. It's actually going to be opening February 15th here in Chicago, so next Friday.
Saigon. Shit. I'm still only in Saigon. Every time I think I'm gonna wake up back in the jungle. When I was home after my first tour, it was worse. I'd wake up and it'd be nothing. I hardly said a word to my wife until I said yes to a divorce. When I was here, I wanted to be there. When I was there, all I could think of was getting back into the jungle. I'm here a week now, waiting for a mission. Getting softer.
My movie isn't about Vietnam. My movie is Vietnam. Francis Ford Coppola famously said, we go from his son Roman in his latest film to one of my all-time favorite films, and maybe, just maybe, Francis Ford Coppola's last great film, 1979, Apocalypse Now. That's certainly up for debate. But after that, you look at the 80s and 90s and even what he's done recently, it's a little bit of a wasteland. And that helps us get back to our top five this week, directors who need a comeback. Coppola is one of those guys who, as I said earlier in the show, I left off because he's one of those old masters for me who I'm not really sure is even capable probably of making a great film. I saw Youth Without Youth, which he made a couple films ago, 2005 or 6. Tim Roth, I love the performance Tim Roth gives in that movie. The movie overall, a little bit uneven. I have not seen Tetro, but Coppola, obviously one of our legendary directors, and I know a lot of people would love to see him make another Apocalypse Now or a Godfather. Probably just not going to happen.
Well, that's why I left him off my list, is because I haven't even seen his last two films. Youth Without Youth was my last Coppola film as well.
Well, let's get back to our countdown, and for people who just joined the show or people who were, I don't know, distracted by the attractive person on the EFX machine next to them while they were working out and missed our 5 through 3 picks, Josh, recap yours.
Jim Jarmusch was number 5, and at 4 I had George Romero. Went a little old school there, possible old master. Number 3 was Jane Campion.
My number 5 was Mike Judge of Beavis and Butthead fame, but also Office Space and Idiocracy. Dylan Kidd, the maker of Roger Dodger. And my number 3 was Cameron Crowe. Last great film, I would argue almost famous. He does have another one coming out here in the next year or so, and hopefully that will be a return to form. We're at our final two picks. Josh, who's your number 2?
It's someone I stayed loyal to far longer than I probably should have, M. Night Shyamalan. I liked The Village quite a bit, and I will even defend Lady in the Water.
You will?
Yes, I will defend.
And then why does he need to
I will
back?
Defend parts of Lady in the Water. Well, I was primed to probably be the only person on the planet who went for The Happening. Didn't happen.
Oh, yeah.
You forgot The Happening?
Well, I've tried. I've tried hard.
Then he made The Last Airbender, which just seemed to me at the time to be like a director for hire job, just something he had to do to prove he could deliver a movie. So I didn't bother seeing that one. From what I can tell from the reaction and the response to it, it was even worse than just doing a job. Now, if you've seen his first two films, which were very mediocre, they were actually Praying with Anger from 92, and then he made a film called Wide Awake in 1998, you have to wonder. It's almost as if something happened to him from about The Sixth Sense through, I'd argue, The Village, where he was touched with this sort of filmmaking genius that somehow just dissipated. It's been taken away. Now, we'll have to see if he can get that back. His next project is the Will Smith sci-fi drama After Earth. Maybe that'll prove my theory wrong. I don't know. I love some of his pictures so dearly. I would really like to see that happen.
I would too, though I think maybe I didn't even consider him for this list because I've so given up.
You've just
on
completely
Shyamalan.
Most people have.
I've completely tried to forget about him, and that's interesting because as you talk about how good some of his films were and how he was regarded, it makes me think there was a while after Unbreakable and Signs and certainly following The Sixth Sense that it was almost like he was our new Hitchcock.
People talked about
him
like
that. People talked about him in those same
not
terms.
Not so many critics, but he did. The Spielberg comparison came out a lot, too,
Spielberg,
because he
even more
had the popular appeal as well as what I felt were some very artistic projects.
Yeah, I think for me, he should be an even bigger candidate for my list than your list because I didn't really like The Village. I think there's a great film somewhere in The Village. It doesn't end the way The Village does. And that's maybe where the wheels started to completely come off because I couldn't get behind at all The Lady in the Water, and I hated The Happening so much that I never bothered to see The Last Airbender. But I did really like The Sixth Sense, and I liked Unbreakable, and I thought Signs was pretty effective,
love
too.
Signs.
So with those three films, if he could make another film at the same level as those three, that would be wonderful. I'm with you. My number two is David Gordon Green. I'm dubbing him, for the purposes of my list, the Lost Poet. If you look at his first four movies, we're going to go back down the same path a little bit with Shyamalan here. You've got George Washington, All the Real Girls, Undertow, and Snow Angels. I'm not even sure who you would compare him to based on those four films. He was his own unique brand of filmmaker. He's someone who, this is the best I can come up with, who blended the realism of Cassavetes and Cassavetes' focus on relationships with the lyricism of maybe a Bresson. And his characters often suffered in his films as much as they do in Bresson films. So that is a pretty great combination, and I'd love to see that guy making films again. Unfortunately, after Snow Angels in 2007, here's what we've had from David Gordon Green. Pineapple Express, Your Highness, The Sitter, Prince Avalanche, that is coming out in 2013, know nothing about it. And then he's got two more films I'll get to in a moment that are set to be released this year and next year. I've seen one or two of those, Josh. The other ones I didn't even bother to see. I'm sure there are some moments of humor there, some inspired bits of humor, but I can't help but want to go back and see the guy who made George Washington, and then the guy who made All the Real Girls, that guy who I really felt had a unique voice. And when I watch those other films or see scenes from those other films, those recent comedies, I feel like just about any director for hire, any Hollywood hack could make those films. So we're really missing David Gordon Green now, and he's got a film set for a 2013 release in addition to Prince Avalanche. It's called Joe. It stars Nicolas Cage. As we talk about people who are in need of a comeback, he's an ex-con who, according to this description, meets a 15-year-old boy and has to decide whether or not to help him and be redeemed or run from him. Sounds like a story we've seen a million times on screen, but it's a drama. Maybe it will be a good comeback for both David Gordon Green and Nicolas Cage. After that, he's remaking Dario Argento's Suspiria, which I'm fascinated by. I'm fascinated by the notion of anybody daring to remake Suspiria, which is a film I actually like quite a bit. He doesn't seem like the most obvious candidate to make that film, and I'm not sure he'll do something interesting with it or not, but I'm at least curious about that. Will we ever see him, though, return to the form and the promise of those early films? I don't know.
What?
Why haven't you ever kissed me?
I'm scared. Scared that when Tip asked me if I ever kissed you, I'd have to say yep.
That scares you?
And Tip is my best friend. I don't want to mess with that.
I don't want to be with somebody that's scared to be with me.
Well, mostly I don't want it to be like when I kissed other girls.
You are right on with David Gordon Green. He is my number one. It's been a really distressing career to watch. You mentioned Cassavetes, which I think is very apt. That makes a lot of sense. I would throw in that mix, rather than Bresson, I would say Terrence Malick, actually.
Yeah, you're right.
Because he has that sort of eye, but I really like the Cassavetes point, too, because they are so relationship-driven, those early really good films. Mm-hmm. All the Real Girls is just amazing. And I think, can we just all agree that at first it may have seemed kind of fun that this guy, this mini Malick, was going to start making these druggy, dumb comedies? Maybe we're like, oh, well, let's see what that's like. It's turned into a problem. I mean, it's become a problem now. And I probably have a higher tolerance for those sorts of films than you. I thought Pineapple Express was amusing. Then we got Your Highness, which was just dreadful. I didn't bother with The Sitter either. And really the problem here, it's not to me that David Gordon Green shouldn't be making these. If he had decided this is what I'm interested in, this is where I want to go, and he turned out these fantastic comedies, great. But the fact is, I don't think he's that good at them. I don't think that's where his talents lie, at least compared to what we've seen earlier. So that's what makes it so frustrating to me to see him continue to make movies like this.
Well, we can continue to cross our fingers that maybe Joe will be the answer, or maybe Prince Avalanche. That doesn't sound like it will be, but...
Well, it sounds like it's more of a comic drama.
Okay.
Different than just these straight-ahead, pure, big comedies that we've been getting.
All right. Well, that's David Gordon Green. My number two pick, your number one pick for a director who is most in need of a comeback. My number one is the director of a movie that has come up so many times here. It's headed for the film spotting pantheon, and I'm starting to wonder if this director should too. It would certainly help his cause if he'd made anything good since that movie. The movie I'm talking about is Mulholland Drive from 2001, and my number one is David Lynch. I did consider that he might be an old master. He might be one of those Coppolas who we shouldn't consider for this list, just not quite eligible, because maybe he's frankly just kind of past his prime. He's 67 now, if my math is correct, and he made Eraserhead in 1977. So he's certainly older than anybody else who appears on my list by a fair amount. But the way I thought about it, Josh, and why he's my number one is, if I could make a wish and pick any one living director, and I could ensure that his next film would be something on par with his best work, on par with Mulholland Drive, on par with Blue Velvet, I'd want to see that next David Lynch film. That would be my wish, something that challenged me the way those two films did. And some of his other work has. I called him for this list the surrealist. I still think that's a perspective we need on screen, and I don't know that anybody else brings it the same way David Lynch does. And in this digital age, too, a guy who is pushing those boundaries, who is working with digital in interesting ways, and fascinated, it seems, by the impermanence of things, including digital photography. I think, too, about my theme for 2012, so many films that talked about the different ways of knowing in the digital age and objective truth versus subjective truth. That's been David Lynch's domain for 25 years or 30 years. I don't think anybody mixes reality and fantasy in more provocative ways than him. So I need David Lynch on that wall. I want David Lynch on that wall, and maybe someday we'll get him back. But ever since Mulholland Drive, he's been making a lot of shorts. He's made some video documentaries, but that's really it. Inland Empire was the last feature in 2006, a movie that has a few moments that really linger with you, and that's both a positive thing and a negative thing. It's a film that overall I found very befuddling, but I also appreciated a lot of what he was trying to do with the digital photography.
You're probably a David Lynch fanatic, whereas I am an appreciator. I appreciate his films more, but you are right in that he's such a particular talent that when he's not making movies that matter, it does leave a gaping hole. So, yeah, it'd be good to see him back too.
What about some honorable mentions?
I thought about Cassie Lemons, actually, who broke out with... Yeah, it's hard to think of how long ago Eve's Bayou was. And she followed that up with... It was less accomplished, but it was still very idiosyncratic, The Caveman's Valentine.
Right.
She was last heard from she's kind of doing standard biopic duty with the Don Cheadle film Talk to Me.
Did you see Talk to Me?
I did, and the performances are really strong in it.
Cheadle and Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Yeah, they are, but it's not by any means a film that speaks of her talents, at least what we saw in her previous two.
I think I'd agree with you.
Caveman's Valentine,
for that film here on the show.
Caveman's Valentine is, I guess you could argue, less successful in some ways, but it had more personality.
Yeah.
I guess I'd put it
that way.
That's
a great choice.
And here's a weird one that I just threw out there because I really love Sky Captain and The World of Tomorrow. And I know not many people do. It's a total effects movie, but it was really at the beginning of green screen, blue screen technology. It's a landmark in CGI work. Kerry Conran was the mastermind behind that, and he hasn't been heard of since. That was 2004. IMDb lists a short film called Gumdrop from last year, but that's all I know. It's just one film he made. I don't know what else he might be capable of, but I'd at least like to see it. You mentioned Cameron Crowe. Honorable mention for me. One more I'll throw out there, Harold Ramis.
Yeah. It's certainly been a while since we've seen anything really good from Harold Ramis. And for me, I've got one guy that I really did consider, ultimately left him off because I don't think it's a matter of having doubts about how good his films will be or whether or not his next film will be good. It's just a time factor. And that's Todd Field, who made the great film In the Bedroom in 2001. Took him 5 years to make Little Children in 2006, a movie I also really appreciated. And then that's it. He hasn't made anything since. He's got a new film called The Creed of Violence that's in pre-production right now. So that could be a 2014 movie. That'll be 8 years between the time he's made Little Children and his latest film. So again, time just the main factor with Todd Field. Carl Franklin is a guy who made great films. 1992, One False Move, great action movie. 1995, Devil in a Blue Dress. That's a movie I'm always championing and talking about here on the show. But after that, man, it's been High Crimes, I think that Ashley Judd thriller, and a lot of TV stuff, and that's really kind of it. I don't know what happened to Carl Franklin. Hopefully we'll see more from him at some point. I think, too, you got to mention Garth Jennings. He made The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in 2005, a movie I didn't love, but I did love his follow-up, Son of Rambo, in 2007. Nothing since then. And finally, Curtis Hanson. This is the guy who made L.A. Confidential, followed that up with Wonder Boys, and I also liked, after that, 8 Mile. I even like In Her Shoes, so maybe that's why I didn't put Curtis Hanson actually in my top five. But Lucky You in 2007 was a terrible film, and his latest was a film he co-directed, that movie that made no money, that looked awful. I didn't see it, in fairness, but that Gerard Butler inspirational film, Chasing Mavericks, he co-directed that. So Curtis Hanson, please come back to the L.A. Confidential days.
But he's also the kind of director where if you saw his name listed on a film, would you genuinely get excited about it because he was involved?
Not as excited as I would most of the people on my list, but yes, just based on those first three films, I might. I would give him the benefit of the doubt, but that's starting to wane, unfortunately. Those are our top five directors who need a comeback. We can't wait to hear your picks. Send us your list or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out in limited release this weekend, opening here in Chicago, John Dies at the End. This is written and directed by Don Coscarelli, who made his last film in 2002, another director making a comeback. That was Bubba Ho-Tep with Bruce Campbell. But he did also make the 80s classic Beastmaster.
Oh, yeah, that's
right.
We
all remember watching that as a kid. Paul Giamatti is in John Dies at the End. I believe that's playing here at the Music Box. In wide release, Identity Thief is out. Melissa McCarthy and Jason Bateman in this film. Again, we sort of continue the director's in need of a comeback. This is Seth Gordon, who made one of my favorite documentaries of the last 10 years, The King of Kong. And since then, he made Horrible Bosses, and now Identity Thief. It could be good. I'm totally prejudging it, but it's not a film I'm excited to see at all. And I'd like to see him go back to making, I guess, a little more smaller personal films like King of Kong.
I don't know if I want to see Identity Thief, but I do want to see the outtakes, the Melissa McCarthy outtakes. Yeah. I'd be willing to sit through about 90 minutes of those.
Fair enough. Also out wide, Side Effects, the new film from Soderbergh, and supposedly the last film by Steven Soderbergh, written by the Contagion scribe Scott Burns. It stars Channing Tatum, Rooney Mara, and Jude Law. Next week on the show, we will talk about Side Effects, and whether it's romantic or not, it's Valentine's Day weekend. So we're going to share our top five romantic gestures on screen. I have a feeling this is one I'm going to need some help. So if you've got some great gestures in cinema that come to mind, send them to us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
We're going to crush a lot of people's hopes here because this is also such a personal topic that if people send in suggestions and we discard them, we're kind of just stamping on their past.
We're horrible people.
Yeah, well, that's going
to
happen.
We'll get to, as well, the third film in our Marx Brothers marathon, Duck Soup.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured music this week was actually from the soundtrack to A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan III. It was by Chicago's own Liam Hayes. You can find more information at liamhayesandplush.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.